And we are live. And one and a two. Hello, my name is Joshua Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks, and we are here to discuss Lower Decks and how love bites in Starfleet. And we can get into a lot of nerd issues here, but this is one of the most nerd reference rich episodes of Lower Decks to date. Because we're going to talk about that Kirk Sunday with Trip Tucker Sprinkles and how they're just loving the fans in a way that you cannot imagine. Now, with me, as always, to discuss Star Trek Lower Decks is Steve Chu and Nari Ely. Steve is an assistant U.S. attorney down in San Diego, and you can imagine how much fun he's having right now with fires because it's raining ash here in San Jose. So it's a lot like the end of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And so it's not good. Utah would be a wonderful place to go right now, or Colorado, where it's 100 and then snows the next day.
Or DC, which is having unseasonably temperate climate right now. Sorry, guys.
Exactly. And it's okay, California's burning. And also with us is Nari Ely, who's with the US courts, and that's all we're going to say about that. And we're going to talk about how love plays out in Cupid's errant arrow, which is just a ton of fun. Now we got an outline of issues, and being lawyers, we're going to opine on a lot of stuff. So if you're law students, take notes, kids, because this is going to be a rip-roaring good time. So Steve, can you walk us through what happens in this episode?
Absolutely. My pleasure. Always love to talk about Star Trek. And I will just to piggyback on what you were saying, Josh, just to acknowledge all that is happening. I mean, this has been a very eventful year. And these wildfires right now are not just in California. They're also in Washington State, in Colorado, in Oregon. I mean, we're seeing them all over the West Coast. So this is some rough stuff. So of course, fingers crossed that we get through all this okay. And it's times like this that I think it's even more important to have fun stuff like this to enjoy, to kind of, for mental health breaks, just to have fun, to geek out. So that's why we're here, and hopefully we can provide everyone some fun here. So episode five, it is called Cupid's Errant Arrow. And I noticed that you titled tonight's episode, Josh, Love Bites. I don't know if that's a reference to the Def Leppard song, although that was one of my favorites back in the 80s. I seem to remember some very awkward sixth grade dances, playing that song where the guys were against one wall, the girls were against the other wall, and we all just kind of stared at each other, and everyone was a little too, or at least maybe I'm just talking about myself, we were all just a little too afraid to make any sort of move.
No, that's
Steve,
normal.
I will also chime
And
in. I mean, I don't think we're necessarily a representative population sample, but I too found middle school to be a very awkward time.
Well, that normal. That was on the flip side, Def Leppard's Hysteria album is one of the best rock and roll albums of all time.
Oh,
When
awesome.
they released that baby, yeah, they did a listening party and they played the entire thing. It's like, wow, this is full of number ones.
Every
So yeah,
song,
that's part of it.
every song was
Every
great.
song.
Yeah, with
I'm gonna nod along. I think I'm a little young for this one.
80s rock, Nari. Yes.
So gather around the Snapchat and we'll tell you about, what it was like in the
Right,
old days.
yeah. Well, speaking of the old days, there are many references to the old days of Star Trek in this episode. So let's talk about this episode a little bit. The premise is, fairly straightforward. We get Brad Boimler, and we learned his full name is Brad Word, not Brad Ford, but Brad Word Boimler, his girlfriend Barb Bimler, is supposed to come on board for a mission with the USS Vancouver, a Parliament class ship, which focuses on complex large-scale engineering projects. And we learned that the mission for this episode is that there is a moon that is going to plummet and destroy a planet if there's no intervention. So Starfleet has been called in to help. And we get into all sorts of issues now about how much can Starfleet intervene here? And then also the mixing of these two crews and what it's like for the two ships to work together. I'll also note, I noticed that the episode opens up with a captain's log. It's a cold open. There's no actual beginning scene before the credits or, you know, before the intro music. And the captain's log, or the log at least, is provided by Boimler. So we don't really hear the captain's log. We hear good old Boimler's log. And in the very first episode, we hear, you know, we see Mariner giving Boimler quite a bit of a hard time about making his own logs. So it's an interesting beginning. So let's right off the bat, we are on the bridge. The captain of the Vancouver is talking to Captain Freeman from the Cerritos, saying, hey, you know, if you play your cards right, maybe someday you'll get to command a ship like this. So, you know, again, 24th century, there's all sorts of envy and competition. And we move into a diplomatic issue right away because the captains open up sort of the ready room and you see a number of people, natives from the planet, who have many objections to Starfleet's intervention. Here are a few of them. We hear the native population say, this is one of the moons we pray to. Another says, this controls the tides of the summer crop. Another person says, my family has lived on the moon for generations. And still, of course, we have the good old person in the back saying, moons cannot plummet. The government made it up. So even in, you know, we have sort of your conspiracy theorists. Nari or Josh, you know, how do we deal with legal challenges? I mean, these aren't formal challenges, I suppose. You know, they haven't filed for temporary restraining orders or anything like that, but it's kind of similar. These people are making an appearance in front of Starfleet saying, you're supposed to be the good guys, and we have all these concerns. We don't want you to intervene. What do we do? Can Starfleet intervene?
Well, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, just right out of the gate. So, and if billions of people are going to die, yeah, especially if these are Federation members, it would be like saying, oh, there's a fire, but we're not going to do anything. Like, we don't do that. We're going to make every effort to help people because we're the good guys. On that note, getting people to play nice, you know, this is like, you know, the folks who see the hurricane coming and decide, I'm staying. That Category 5 isn't going to chase me off my land. And then they die horribly. Well, this is to make sure people don't die horribly by taking out this moon that has a chunk out of it. So it's not like it's some happy, fun land. Clearly, there's been a mass environmental disaster. It needs to be addressed. They have all these orbital platforms around it to help stabilize it, and those are only temporary, so they do not you know, they can't last forever, so they have to take some action now. Making sure everyone plays nice, well,
if I could play devil's advocate here for just a second, I think Steve, before we started recording, you mentioned that there was an episode called First Contact, in which Starfleet had made first contact, and we can assume that this civilization has already made official first contact, right? They actually have formal relations, so we assume Prime Directive doesn't apply, they've achieved warp, that kind of stuff. I don't recall if it was addressed explicitly as to whether or not they were just a new civilization that they had made contact with, or if they were actually members of the Federation, because that can make a difference.
Right.
And if they're just a new civilization, if they are asked to leave, even if Starfleet thinks it's so obviously in their interest for them to intervene, they would have to leave. On the other hand, I can't remember the name of the episode, but there was an episode of I believe it was Next Gen, in which, as a result of a treaty negotiated between Starfleet and the Cardassians, a border had moved, and a planet that had been colonized by Native Americans from Earth was being asked to relocate because they are now on the other side of the border. And in that circumstance, it put Starfleet and Picard in the very difficult position of nonetheless needing to observe law because they were Federation citizens. And at that point, they had an obligation to follow Federation law, which included this planet now belongs to the Cardassians. So if, for example, they were a member of the Federation, I don't know, maybe the Federation had ordered this to happen as a democratic process, then I think it would be different. So I'm going to assume we're in the latter situation and not in the former, or that some part of their government has already invited Starfleet to be there, and these are simply objectors, and that can happen all the time. We would expect that, right? And the goal is to try to placate them, but not necessarily that they're going to be a veto here.
So those are good points, Nari. The Next Generation episode to which you are referring is called Journey's End. And it actually came in the seventh season. It was pretty close to the end. I watched it recently, you know, where Wesley encounters the Traveler again and decides to leave with the Traveler to go on these amazing journeys to see wonders, you know, here before untold or unknown. This is very interesting, though. It just occurred to me when you were saying this that in this room of people, you know, that are objecting, among the objectors, we don't actually see anyone who claims to or identifies themselves to be an official member of the government.
Yes.
You know, so there's no chancellor, no senator, no president, no diplomat, no ambassador. These appear to be sort of like fringe members who are just objecting. And, you know, they may very well have legitimate reasons, but we can probably assume that the government has already officially asked Starfleet for help. Otherwise, why would Starfleet be there? And then maybe the government said, okay, we're tired of dealing with these objectors. Here, you guys just go talk to Starfleet. Captain Freeman, hey, it's your problem now. And she gets to play mediator. Josh.
It's a lot of things at play here. So on one level, Starfleet's acting like the Army Corps of Engineers. And like saying, the levee's going to break, or we have to fix the levee, and some farmland's going to get flooded, or whatever the case is. And if we don't do it, towns are going to get flooded. So, like, this has to change. And this is like homeowners or property owners attending a city council meeting or a land management meeting and having their due process with expressing their views. Granted, this is on multiple moons around this planet, so that's different for what like we're used to for how local government works. But I do think, you know, the Vancouver, again, also continuing the West Coast city name tradition, and Vancouver is awesome. Love that city, but it's very. They're like the Army Corps of Engineers.
I'm really glad you brought up that example, because there are situations in real law, in U.S. law, where this kind of thing comes up, especially in the context of flood management or flood control or flood mitigation, whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of federal flood control projects in the United States as opposed to state, most famously probably along the Mississippi River. The Army Corps of Engineers has a lot of levees and other systems built there in order to control what was a natural floodway, and there were very disastrous floods that went every year, every couple of years through the Mississippi River. And so since, I believe it was 1939, the Supreme Court decision in U.S. v. Sponenbarger, I'm sure everyone knows that case, it was decided that something called the relative benefits doctrine would apply if any landowner whose property had been damaged as a result of a flood management program or a flood intervention could not bring a claim for damages, or basically they wouldn't succeed in showing liability against the government, if the benefit of the program, or perhaps even the specific intervention, accrued to that specific property. So it's not necessarily just a general public benefit outweighing private injury, right? It's this specific property. How much benefit has accrued to this property as a result of the flood management program, or even this specific instance where, for example, and this does happen, that a levee is weakened due to, you know, shifting sands in the river or whatever, and so there's a high chance of a breach unless pressure is let off. This is actually not that uncommon. And so in that case, you would have moderate property damage, but you have to compare that property owner's state of affairs to what the alternative is, right? And what would the state of their property have been? How much damage would, or benefits, or not damage, but how much damage would have accrued had the government not done anything? right? Because that's essentially what the law is about. It's if a person is injured, you're supposed to make them whole, right? What would they have been absent this wrongful injury? And so just assuming that this intervention may have been a wrongful injury, what would have happened if the government hadn't done anything? And in most cases, although certainly not all, but in a lot of cases, the property owner themselves would have been had a lot higher damage, either in the absence of a flood management program that prevents yearly floods, or even in that specific instance, right? So you may have had 15% property damage, which is quite substantial, but compare that to a catastrophic levee breach in which your entire house would have been wiped out, right? And so that's the question. So you usually don't compare it, again, to the general public benefit, because this is kind of, and we'll come to this in just a second, you know, the government is empowered in certain circumstances to take an overwhelming public interest into account against a private property owner, but they still usually have to compensate them in those circumstances. So that's not what we're talking about here. What we're just talking about is the benefits, the relative benefit of versus cost of whatever, in this case, a flood mitigation project. In this case, we're talking moon crashing into the planet. And I just want to highlight that Trek, compared to a lot of other sci-fi shows, takes the science seriously. This is real. If a significant stellar body like a moon crashes into an atmosphere, it compresses the atmosphere so quickly that will literally turn into plasma. And all life on the planet, basically, except for, I don't know, if there's maybe something in a deep ocean crevasse that somehow doesn't get instantly evaporated, is going to be gone. It's all dead.
Yeah, we call that Mars. So yeah, that used to be a nice place. Not anymore. The other thing that this is different from, and we'll talk about this in one level in just a second, is it's not like one of those Eisenhower projects where we're going to flood this area and build a dam and that town that's there is going to be submerged so everyone has to move out because we're building a new dam and we're going to make an artificial lake. This is not that situation.
Yeah.
This isn't, hey, this place is going to be super cool if we get rid of this moon and we can harvest the remains of it. It's completely different because we don't want everyone to die.
The absence of intervention in this case is catastrophic damage. And it is, I believe, for every one of these people who object, right? Including the people who live, including and especially the people who live on the moon.
Right.
The alternative here, what state would you be in absent intervention, is extremely dead.
I would say that factor weighs pretty heavily in favor of intervention here.
And the last thing I wanted to say is that none of that would actually serve to like get an injunction. This is all after the fact compensation.
Right.
You are not going to succeed by going to a courthouse and saying, please issue an emergency injunction against the Army Corps of Engineers because I don't want them to let some flood water out of my property.
So procedurally, there's a couple steps there. I mean, what Nari is talking about is ultimately what's called a preliminary injunction, which is a little more permanent and requires a little more time. In reality, this sort of fact scenario is not that unusual, where the government or some entity has to take quick action over a certain property and someone wants to stop them. And if that person wants to stop them, they can try to go for an injunction, though that'll take time. So it's really a two-step process. First is they'll move for what is called a temporary restraining order. And that's something that is done very, very quickly. Courts can rule within 24 hours and they can stop action on the part of companies or governments or whatnot, pending a hearing until such time that the court can have a hearing on the preliminary injunction, which may take longer. However, it's important to note that one of the requirements to get that TRO granted is that the applicant must show that they have a likelihood of success on the merits. So they have to show that they actually have a pretty good case. They can't just say, I just don't want it to happen. And the court says, oh, okay, well, you know, in that case, we'll just kick this can down the road for 30 days and stop everything. And maybe, you know, even if you have absolutely no chance of winning, we'll still stop it. No, it doesn't work like that. Under the legal requirements, the applicant has to show that they have a pretty decent chance of winning. It's got to be, you know, a viable or a colorable challenge. So with that in mind, you know, if these
And another factor is they have to show the public interest.
Correct. The public interest is a very powerful factor. Right. And obviously here, the public interest was way heavily in favor of intervention. I mean, on the one hand, you have total, you know, destruction of the planet, On the other hand, you have, you know, a summer home or something, or, you know, the vacation home for two people. You know, it's not hard to see where the court would probably come down there. But let me ask then, these people who are objecting, and we have sort of four groups of objectors, let's say that they don't change their mind and they keep saying, no, you just can't do this. You can't do this. Can they stop the intervention? Can they stop Starfleet from doing this? Or could Starfleet just say, well, to heck with you, we're going to do it?
Well, so I think what we'd be looking at there is, again, so we're moving out of the emergency scenario where they're stopping a levee from breaching, and there does appear to be a little time for some back and forth here between the captain and the groups. I think what we might be analogizing more closely to now would be perhaps eminent domain. So especially in the case of people who say that they own property on the moon and you're destroying it. In some states, at least, I think, I don't know if every state has an eminent domain statute, but a lot of states, the state can, under the right circumstances, if they meet the right conditions, basically take the property and give fair market value compensation, and you can litigate about it later, but you can't stop them from building on your property.
Right. So you'll get remedies after the fact, but you can't stop them up front.
And that's exactly to avoid problems of like holdouts, right, when, you know, you need to buy 100 parcels of land to build a highway, and the last two people or one person is holding out because they know that the entire value of the project is riding on their house and they're looking for more than fair market
value. So we also see Captain Freeman sort of take on another role in the grand tradition of Starfleet captains. Picard did this many times. Kirk did this as well. They act as mediators to try to mediate these disputes. And Captain Freeman comes up with some solutions for resolving these issues. Namely, she says, for the folks with the religious issue, she says, all right, we'll relocate 3 tons of moon dust for the people to worship. For the farmers, you'll have gravity systems installed for the tide, therefore mimicking the gravitational pull of the moon. And oh, you three, your ancestral homes will be relocated to the 6th moon, which will now technically become the 5th moon anyways. You know, so everyone seems to be happy, hunky-dory. She's doing all right. She's a good mediator, right?
Except one person,
the squeaky wheel that demands the grease here, who says, oh, the moon blocks pollution from Mixus 3 from reaching my people on Mixus 2. My people. How many people are there? We later learn that there are 2 people, a grand total of 2 people versus what we can only assume are millions or billions of people on the planet. It's a wealthy couple that does not want to relocate. And it does bring to mind similar real life analogies, like when people refuse to evacuate their home, and Josh alluded to this, when in the face of a fire, a flood, or some other natural disaster. You know, so what's Starfleet supposed to do here? Can they actually forcibly remove these people? Or could they just say, hey, do what you want, and we're gonna go ahead with the intervention?
So, I mean, the only thing I can think of in, you know, our U.S. law context would be if they were living on, like, federal land.
Well, then it's a little different. Then we've got power over them.
Yeah. And that's, unfortunately, that's just about the only case. There are a couple states, there are a handful of states that have imposed certain kinds of liability for people who fail to observe, like, a mandatory evacuation order. But I think North Carolina, Texas, and maybe a few others have made people civilly liable for the cost of their own rescue if they are in a mandatory evacuation area and later need to be rescued. There's a couple states that have actually created misdemeanor criminal liability, but that has basically never been enforced because you're in the middle of a disaster. You're gonna go arrest them. Like, that's what you want to spend.
And you're gonna put your law enforcement in danger for trying to arrest them.
Yes.
Which is sort of counterintuitive in some ways. So I think the answer here is that if this couple, let's just say hypothetically, they say, yeah, there's only 2 of us, but we absolutely refuse to evacuate from this moon. It's our home. You can't kick us out of here. We're going to, even if it does fall apart, we're going down with the ship. I think in that situation, legally, Starfleet is without a remedy. They just have to say, okay, well, we've tried our best and we're going to go ahead with the intervention. And, you know, if they die, they die, I suppose. Or they don't intervene and they die anyways, right? So.
And I'll say that this appears to be the one group, but the one objector who is not in a position in which, you know, if Starfleet does nothing, they'll be really worse off. They seem to live on another moon. It's unrelated to any of the other moons. And they seem to be just fine with the idea that the planet is killed. So technically, they are not actually going to be worse off. They'll be the same. If Starfleet does nothing, they'll be worse off if Starfleet does something. And as weird as it sounds, this would be exactly the right case where they could try to bring and probably succeed in bringing a takings claim. It's the idea that although the public interest clearly outweighs whatever they're doing, they are suffering property loss as a result of the action in the public interest. The public therefore compensates them for the value to their property that is lost, or, for example, you know, the cost of installing something to block the pollution other than the moon. So, and that actually, to me, seems rather just.
So the takings claim would be brought under the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment due process. There are specific provisions for this where someone, if the government has in effect taken their property, it doesn't have to be a physical taking. It doesn't have to be kicking you off the property. It could be doing something which affects your enjoyment of the property, which would be the case here. The person can then seek redress, typically monetary redress from the government. Whether or not that would be successful, we don't know. And even if it is successful, then there's a question of how much would they get. And again, we don't know.
And I just want to highlight that this would be, for example, the change in the analogy here is that it would be the Army Corps of Engineers diverting Harbor River, for example. You know, it might feel weird to us because this is like a super whiny wealthy couple that we
don't like,
but it could just as easily, and it could just as easily has been, you know, some very destitute couple that had been eking out a living trying to turn the moon into farmland. And the law doesn't necessarily recognize how we feel about parties compared to
So I think we could talk the whole episode about just these issues, because there's a lot of thorny diplomatic legal issues.
This was a great episode.
Yeah, and the episode doesn't even spend the majority of its time on these particular issues, but they're there, and there's just a lot of legal depth there. So moving onwards, you know, we get sort of a, I don't know if it's the B plot or the C plot here, but the Cerritos is falling apart. There are plasma fires. Oh, D-53 sparked again. It's very buggy. The whole ship is kind of falling apart. Is this a safe workplace? You know, I thought about some of the OSHA regulations. You know, when you're seeing sparks and fires and you're thinking, yeah, people could get hurt just sort of walking around or having to work here. I don't know.
Plasma fires.
Plasma. Burning very, very hot. Yeah. I don't know. Any thoughts on this, you guys?
So there are enacted under President Nixon, and those state that you know, personal injuries and illnesses arising out of work situations can pose a substantial burden upon and are a hindrance to interstate commerce in terms of a loss production, wage loss, medical expenses, and disability compensation payments. Even taking aside the military issue of, you know, the Cerritos being in Starfleet and a Starfleet vessel, you still want it to be safe. And, you know, they don't want to have asbestos type litigation with people who, you know, that we still have, of people who built ships that were used in the Navy and they had asbestos poisoning. And like, there's lots of litigation. Law firms are dedicated to that. Now, a lot of those people are, I think it's a shrinking population, but you had lots of people who served on those ships who were exposed to asbestos and had horrible health problems because of it. So taking that as a baseline, employers are to furnish each of their employees employment and a place of employment which are free from recognized hazards that are causing or likely to cause death or serious harm to their employees. If your ship's catching fire, yeah, you got problems because that's a super hot plasma fire. Also, airborne you also have the airborne contaminant issue as well. So, you know, Lord knows what they're breathing, but they're constantly putting out little fires, and The sound effect that they use is a Doctor Who sound effect from the sonic screwdriver.
Very good.
It's quite the catch.
That was awesome.
Again, high school, college, law school, not dating. You know, you remember these things. Steve married, I didn't. So, but those are the things I notice. And I thought, like, well, that's a little subtle Doctor Who reference. In addition to the time travel discussion that they have in going back to the 1920s. So there's some fun there with that. That said, yeah, the ship needs some time in space, Doc. It needs a lot of TLC.
Regularly scheduled retrofit or whatever they usually do. What's going on there?
Right. Where are the Starfleet, you know, inspectors, the health inspectors, workplace safety inspectors? It occurs to me while you're describing all this, Doc, and I think you're absolutely correct on all of these issues, that Starfleet, we would expect to have a safety code for their ships, their workplaces. But what we're seeing here with all these sort of reckless dangers, that's something that I think as Star Trek fans, we come to expect a little bit more from other species, such as the Klingons, you know, who mind Praxis to the point of it exploding, you know, foregoing safety precautions. Maybe the Ferengi, who only care about profit. But I don't think we would expect this from the Federation. The Federation is, you know, they're more by the book, aren't they?
I would say so. You also just have regular scheduled maintenance. Like we have, you know, with our Navy, or let's just say ferry boats that are certified to carry passengers for hire, there are annual haul out schedules that they have to follow, time out of the water, work done on them, and certifications that they need to meet for, like, say, through hole fittings, checking all the life jackets, showing that you can do man overboard drills, all that good stuff. So you think there would be something similar here, and that this is a ship of the line. Like, sure, it might be the B team doing second contact, but that's no reason for neglected vessels to be out there. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, like the relic scene of Scotty and Picard talking about knowing how fast the ship was going by how the deck plates vibrated, and like those other nostalgic feelings that you can have about a vessel being persnickety with its own sense of humor, because they are living things. They are.
Especially by the time you get to Voyager and they use neural packs.
Right.
Yeah. So, but ships are definite creatures, because they have personalities, and I say that affectionately, having spent lots of time around both. But I would think that vessel needs time in the yard to fix these issues and not have delayed maintenance.
I just want to throw in one quick thought of, in defense of the much maligned Ferengi. I believe, as we saw in a couple episodes of DS9, they do appear to have a very robust legal tort system.
Which has almost surprised me.
Yeah, I would not presume that they would be super lax on the safety.
I can't see Quark too, you know, Quark overly worried. Well, Quark would be so worried about, liability and all that stuff at his restaurant. I'm sure he carries good insurance.
There was an episode of DS9 where Quark was misdiagnosed with a fatal illness and is overjoyed to learn when it's a misdiagnosis, because he proclaims he's going to sue the doctor and get rich.
That's right. Not only is he going to live, but he's going to make money. You know, perfect situation. There's a rule of acquisition there somewhere, I'm sure.
Yes.
If your life is threatened, it's worth it so long as you make money, right? And you survive. So I think the bottom line there is Cerritos needs a little TLC. I think we can agree with that. So that takes us to probably the A story arc here of this episode, which is the love story. And Star Trek does a lot of love stories. You know, many of them are serialized, long-term love stories. But there have been a number of episodes also that have dealt with stories such as this. You know, the way this episode deals with the story is that Brad Boimler, Brad Word Boimler, he's sort of described as, you know, this overachiever, trying to please everybody. And Mariner just cannot believe that he might have this attractive, successful partner, girlfriend.
A senior officer to him.
Senior officer, a lieutenant, right? So, you know, is there some issue there too, right? I mean, they're not in the same...
No, they're not serving on the same ship. So I think that resolves some of those issues.
Right. That's usually how folks get around that, from what I understand. But Mariner is, you know, we just get a lot of digs at Boimler. Mariner saying, okay, she's a holodeck character, right? Okay, so, I mean, we have seen that before. There was Minuet from The Next Generation, who later, in an alternate universe type of reality, or holodeck fantasy, was Riker's wife, you know? She's a parasite, she's a shapeshifter. When we hear about her being a shapeshifter, we get this flashback too, to a time when Mariner is on the Keto, and it looks like they're docked at DS9. The Keto itself looks like a vessel very similar to the USS Pasteur, which we saw in All Good Things, the series finale of Next Generation, commanded by Captain Beverly Crusher. I'll just go into this a little bit, but it's very interesting seeing this because during this flashback, Mariner has very different look, some great hair, a different uniform. These are DS9 era uniforms. So it looks like it's the Dominion War time period, or at least around that time. And then they reference, oh, by the way, did you hear that they found Data's brother, Lore, who was in command of the Borg? So we're at, I think that's season 6, that's Descent, part 1 and 2. So we're getting towards the end of the Next Gen run, and we're teeing up for the Dominion War soon. And I guess Mariner is kind of scarred. She's talking to a friend, dating this handsome, rugged guy who turns out to be, we think, a Harvonian shapeshifter, and just chops down and eats her friend, it looks like.
So good.
And in true Trek nerdery, for me at least, the one thing I noticed the most was that all the Starfleet crew members in that 10 forward equivalent had phasers, and they just shot down this creature. And I thought Starfleet members didn't typically carry phasers on them, except in that alternate timeline from yesterday's Enterprise, where the Federation is at war with the Klingons. That's when they all carried phasers walking around the ship. I thought that was a little unusual. Any comments or thoughts here, guys?
They learned, so that's why they're all packing.
The Dominion War might be starting soon. Everyone carry your standard issue Federation phasers, right?
I just want to point out, of course, I do think that this flashback and all of the details that you caught, Steve, serve for fascinating, tantalizing little details about Mariner's mysterious past. It was hinted at in like the second episode with the Klingon general when they're reminiscing about their gray ops, and Boimler says, "Wait, you're not that much older than me. When did you do that?" she is a perhaps indeterminate age. it's interesting. She may actually have quite a long past.
Could she be an Eloran or something like that?
Yeah.
Or like Guinan, you know? Is that possible? And that would be amazing. Mariner is one of the coolest characters I think we've had on Star Trek in quite some time. You just can't quite pigeonhole her into anything. She's very complicated. And one of her favorite roles is to be sort of the difficult big sister character for Boimler, just giving him grief at every opportunity. So we meet Barb. She is attractive. She is capable.
She's everything.
She outranks him. And Mariner is just stupefied. Like, okay, you cannot be real. Are you a hologram? Are you an android? Are you a parasite? As we learn later, there actually is a parasite involved. But ironically, the parasite is not Barb. The parasite is actually on Boimler. This is an episode where we have someone who probably shouldn't be in love with someone else, and yet they are. So what has happened? For me, as an original series fan, it reminded me of the episode This Side of Paradise, where the crew encounters a planet that just removes their inhibitions, and you get Spock, who meets a woman from his past, Layla or Lila, and she's actually developed in some of the Trek novels, too, that Spock knew her back in the Academy, and she professed her love to him, and she started to cry because he couldn't respond. And then he ran away and joined the Enterprise like the next day. There's some interesting backstory there. But so I don't know that there's a lot of legal issues here, but there's a lot of Trek continuity, a lot of juicy stuff here, and a lot of references. Josh, your thoughts about the whole love story arc here?
On one level, it was brilliant Trek lore. And with issues of the necessity defense of thinking Boimler was in mortal danger, about to get impregnated by a tail, and all of the horrible things that could happen, and Mariner is looking out for her friend. I also liked Barb, because it's like, hey, she's together, and it actually, you know, like the end bothered me. I would have preferred it. They remain in a relationship, despite the fact that the parasite's gone, because that would have been different, as opposed to let's just set them up to fall, and that's something that I thought was a missed opportunity. That said, there was a lot of
things. The first is that I think the fact that they did have her immediately after saying, you know, of course I loved you. I'm Starfleet. I don't just fall in love with someone for their pheromones.
was
a really funny way of keeping in theme with something that we've talked about a lot here, which is that, you know, a lot of things have changed in the 24th century, but there are some things that are still the same. And one of them is that, you know, people actually do have preferences. Maybe they're even sometimes shallow. and so she doesn't see Boimler as a catch once the pheromones are gone. I just want to note here also, do we want to talk even briefly about when Mariner shouts citizens court martial?
Yeah, I made a note about that too.
Yeah, that was a really good note, Josh.
Yeah, go for it.
A citizen's court martial? No, that's not going to make sense. But a citizen's arrest? Yes, because if he did assault her by cutting her hair, that's an unwanted physical touching, and that's also an appropriate use of the F word. If that did happen, when normal people would swear. That's just the way people are hardwired. But yeah, they she could arrest the guy and then he would get court-martialed. But again, it was her doing the cutting.
Yes.
And for her defending her would be the necessity of defense of, you know, Your Honor, look at him. There's no way that woman should be attracted to him. Clearly, I'm like, that's the argument. And you can just see the judge sitting there going like, what? So
as
we're the elements of the necessity.
Yeah, we're getting into like a reality show kind of here, aren't we? Like some dating game show.
Yeah, Your Honor, there's no way he has that much game. This is unnatural.
He does not punch this far above his weight class, Your Honor. You know?
it's like this is hurtful at that point in time. And if she's defending herself with, no, he is amazing. And again, that would just be a weird hearing. It'd be a super weird hearing.
And to get briefly just a little bit into the law, I talked at length in a previous panel for Force Fest about citizens' arrest, and I won't go into the whole like 10-minute long spiel here, but just the basics here. So, you know, some states do allow citizens' arrests. The main thing to keep in mind with citizens' arrests and why you should almost never, ever, ever, ever do them, including Mariner in this situation, is that unlike an officer of the peace, when a police officer goes to arrest someone, it doesn't matter if you had the best predicates in the world. So maybe Mariner can somehow convince the judge that she had probable cause to believe that Barb was about to kill Boimler, which, you know, if that's what you thought was going to happen and you had reason, probable cause, that would probably be a good situation to detain someone until the police arrive. However, unlike an officer of the peace, if you are actually wrong, even if you had the right predicate, you are completely open to all of the liability that can flow from that. Be that criminal, because you assaulted someone, and she did. But I mean, I think the hair cutting off is technically an assault, but if she grabbed her, right, that's an assault.
The pants,
she pantsed her, too, in front of a crowd. Yes. I mean, yes. My goodness.
Also, if she succeeded in detaining her, false imprisonment, and all of the, again, civil and criminal liability that can flow from that, because as it turns out, she is not correct. And that is the biggest hazard when it comes to citizens' arrest, is you have to actually be right. You can't just be reasonable.
So poor Boimler, you know, at the end of the episode, he is once again alone. He is no longer with this amazing girlfriend. But, you know, we learn a little bit, and Mariner has now made a new friend in Barb. So the other major storyline going on tracks Rutherford and Tendi. And we alluded to this earlier, you know, the ship is falling apart. Cerritos is falling apart. So they go on to the Vancouver, and I think it's their chief engineer over there, gives them a contest and says, all right, well, we have this cool new piece of equipment, the T-88, which appears to be some great tricorder or something like that. And then he gives them some assignments and says, all right, for your work, gets the T-88. I mean, you know, I kind of raised an eyebrow when I heard that. I thought, well, okay, I think this is government equipment. And he's treating it like a private equipment that he could just auction off or hand out. I'm not sure it quite works that way. I think there are some authorizations and approvals that would typically need to be obtained for, you know, a procurement process. You know, military has their own system. Federal, state, local governments all have their own systems there as well. So we get this contest, and then you know, they're both trying to win this T-88. Tendi and Rutherford both see themselves as potentially being champions if they can bring this back to their respective departments in sciences, you know, medicine, science, and engineering, on the other hand. And this continues onwards. So we start with the contest and the equipment, and we have that issue. And then it moves forward, and then we learn that the chief engineer, he is going to write up a transfer request for whoever wins to transfer from the Cerritos to the Vancouver, because his ulterior motive is he actually wants to transfer from the Vancouver to the Cerritos, because he's just tired of dealing with all these high stakes, you know, huge world changing missions. You know, every mission is about saving the universe, saving the world. And he just wants to be kind of somewhere smaller where he can be left alone to do his own thing. And he swears also, it's interesting, he says that, oh, don't worry, here's the transfer request, I'm writing it up. The Admiral used to be my grandma's neighbor, he's a quiet guy, and he will push it through. So, you know, we get a little, I think that would make some people a little uncomfortable, that he's going to basically pull some strings to make this happen. And he's going to try to transfer these people against their will. Are there some problems here? What do you guys think?
It's not a merit-based transfer. There's fraud involved, because he didn't tell our heroes that I'm switching you. I do wonder, you know, part of me does think that maybe the equipment could be valid, because again, they're still all in Starfleet. And so being able to say you get a T-88 to take back to, you know, your ship as a reward for this. You know, it'd be like the new sound-powered phones or some other cool item that could make work easier. So on that level, that doesn't necessarily offend my senses of, you know, an incentive. But there's huge elements of fraud. And it's worth noting that the T-88, that's also a type of tank used by the People's Republic of China. So when they were talking about that, I was like, well, that's an interesting number that they picked. Why is that familiar? And that would be why, because that's the type of thing I pay attention to.
So we're talking here now about moving on to the transfer. So he wants to transfer these crew members against their will from the Cerritos to the Vancouver so that he in turn can be transferred to the Cerritos and kind of toil away in, you know, a smaller setting and be left alone to his own devices. Transferring against, being transferred against your will, is there an issue with that in Starfleet or in other places? Any thoughts?
So, in the military, yeah. Not so much. I mean, so I think the only issue that could come up is if their captain, right, is the one that's protesting here. So the fact that she seems to be completely out of the loop on this might be an issue. But when it comes to a soldier or an officer receiving their orders, no, I don't think so.
But it's not because it's merit-based or because they requested it or because they're needed. You know, it's one thing to get ordered to go someplace because we, like when you think of all the ramp-ups when we had like hurricane response with the Coast Guard, a friend of mine, she's a captain of the Coast Guard, and like they were doing all the ready reserve staffing on responding to that. Or again, my really good friend, he was on the response for Deepwater Horizon and getting all the orders written to send all the reservists to go respond. Like that's because we need people there. This is, I'm tired of the universe hanging on my decision daily, and I want to go to someplace normal where I'm not surrounded by hyper type A people, and we're going back in time and trying to stop things from happening. I mean, I could see that causing an ulcer. I mean, like that guy's looks middle-aged, no hair thinning. You know, what if he's like 35? and like if that's just the years that like have added, I know, 15 years to his right. health, and just looking like hell. So, I mean, I can understand wanting to get out of a high-stress work environment, but there's fraud and I think improper use of the system to get the transfer. So I do think he'd be in trouble.
So Josh, I think you raise a very good point there, which is it's not the fact of the transfer necessarily, it's how it is being done. If this were a situation where an admiral or the ranking admiral that has jurisdiction over the ships took a look at the rosters and said, you know, I think we need a little more help on the Cerritos. Why don't we Vancouver over and in exchange, we'll swap them for some junior, you know, folks. That'll serve the needs, you know, of both ships and in the best interest of the Federation. Arguably an improper means, you know, who's a neighbor of his grandma. You know, I think that makes us a little bit uncomfortable, certainly. You know, going to Nari's point about the military, and, you know, there's a strong point here, and that is that usually, and when we look at our real world, we have a lot of analogies and examples here. But when someone joins a large organization or a government or a military or something like that, typically, you as an individual give up a lot of rights and you are sort of quote unquote owned by the organization. And we see that, you know, Nari pointed out the military, people have very little control over their transfer orders or their assignments. They, you know, they can cross their fingers and hope for the best, but they may get shipped out overseas to someplace they don't want to go. And that's just life. That's the game. It's similar, you know, in law enforcement. You know, I know folks at the FBI after training, they will sort of hope for a good assignment in a location that they like, but typically it works on a seniority basis. So your first assignment is probably going to be in some place that is considered less desirable. And then one has to work their way up the ranks until they can maybe get to a large city or some other place like that. But they don't have a lot of control over that. You just kind of go where you're told. Medical school too. You know, after completing medical school, people can put in for the residencies that they want. They rank them in a certain order. And then basically they cross their fingers and hope and just see what happens. They get placed, they don't control it, and then they go where they're placed. So the idea of not entirely controlling one's own destiny is not that unusual. So it's...
But Steve, I just want to emphasize, because I think you made a really good point, that I think there's a popular misconception that there's not a lot of law in the military, within the military. But so while there isn't a lot that these junior officers can do in ordinary circumstances, if they're just getting transferred to a place they don't like, there is a lot of process, and process matters, and violations of process matter in the military. This is something that we talk about a lot with, you know, punishing. We talked about in the first episode of punishing officers, right, for bad behavior, things like that. They can do that if they follow the correct process.
So again, yeah, respecting people's individual rights. We in Starfleet is all about individual rights. As we see in this episode, they will go to great lengths to respect the rights of individuals, even if it's just two people protesting over a moon being changed or affected.
I'm not even sure I believe that.
Right. So I think we're right at our hour. We've hit the major issues. Any closing thoughts, guys?
Did either of you watch any of the Star Trek Day panels that were organized on StarTrek.com? And no is an okay answer.
I did not.
Not as much as I wanted. I read a lot of updates, but I was working the whole day, unfortunately.
Yeah, I only was able to watch one at lunchtime, and that was the Strange New World. That cast and creative group has a great reverence and love for the original series and everything that Star Trek is supposed to represent, and hearing them talk about like researching roles and everything and being envious of the writing staff who get to write everything, it's like, okay, that's cool. Definitely wish I could hang out with all of them. And I was able to watch a little of the one that followed that Will Wheaton moderated with George Takei and Rod Roddenberry. And hearing Takei talk about his adventures and filming the naked time and getting to like practice with the sword, because he loved Robin Hood as a kid and like that was his suggestion. Highly, highly endearing, and highly recommend checking those out for anyone listening, because they are very hopeful, very fun, and all the reasons why people love Star Trek. That entire the programming that I saw was done with a lot of love and respect, and all the posts that they had over the course of the day looked pretty awesome.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, Takei and Wheaton are both legends in their own right, you know, from different generations, but still huge impacts on Star Trek. So that I'm going to have to go check out those panels if they are still available then, Josh.
I would, yeah, check StarTrek.com/day. And see what's there. But I highly recommend checking those out, because it's everything that you want to love about Star Trek that they were celebrating and honoring. So it was a nice, again, I was eating lunch in between doing Discovery and preparing declarations and writing a motion. So, you know, fun Tuesday. But it was a nice mental break to see that. So again, if you haven't checked it out, please do so, because it's going to be everything you love. So with that, I want to thank you too for your thoughts and wisdom and being able to geek out over the law. And as we talked about beforehand, everyone was getting out different Star Trek toys that we have floating around, or communicator badges and everything. So it's good to have Trek on a regular basis, and that more is coming, and it's like, oh, thank God.
It's a great time to be a geek.
Yeah. And I can't help but wonder if the good folks at Star Trek took a look at May the 4th and all the things that Star Wars fans do on May the 4th and said, we should do that too.
I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they could have done First Contact Day, but That would have been April.
Yes.
So there'd be a month between the two. But the first air date makes lots of sense. And since that first episode they premiered was the with McCoy's old girlfriend looking abnormally hot to him and blamed everybody else and just sucking the salt out of people left and right. It was very fitting that they had this episode on Lower Decks and actually referenced it. So it's like,
yes.
Don't trust sexy people in rompers.
They're not quite as dangerous. Make sure you ask sexy people in rompers, what are all the rules? What are all the rules in this area?
Before you run off with one and accidentally get a sentence. Yes. Yeah, it's
right.
Fair point. fair point. Not paradise. And so it'd be fun to actually go through the full list of everything, because I know we didn't get every reference, but tons of them in this episode. And
I realized there were even more examples of this problem than made it into the long list that Mariner spouted off, including when Dr. Crusher was seduced by a like plasma ghost. What was that?
Yeah.
Oh God, the Scottish Highlands. It was
which was not Sub Rosa episode,
the 17th episode.
Yeah, it's infecting different women in her family over generations. Creepy, weird. But yeah, they definitely hit like every form of parasitic, love interest that you could have in a Star Trek episode. They rode that pony and rode it hard in this one. And God bless them for doing that.
Lots of love.
Lots of love. And definitely. So with that, everyone, thanks for watching. We'll definitely have more. There'll be a couple of us on Saturday, tomorrow afternoon, for the beginning of Star Wars Saturday that Get Vocal is organizing. So we'll have a couple of us there to talk about that. Because, hey, you can't talk about Star Trek on Friday and Star Wars on Saturday. What more do you need? Maybe a little Babylon 5. Yeah, so there's definitely lots of good stuff here. So everyone, thanks for tuning in and have a wonderful evening.